Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ed Legg continue their discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year, with a look at the record industry's rediscovery of their back catalogs and the quest to find the next Bob Marley. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. Or should I say 80s roll? That's right. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, back once again with Ed Legg to continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. And this week, we're going to be looking at reissues and the attempt to find the next Bob Marley. Ed, welcome.
Glad to be here, Nate.
And so I hope you got your Rasta on for this week because, you know, Bob Marley and all.
Yes, sir. I'm ready for an uprising.
All right. So the story starts this chapter in at Island Records, London, May 8th, 1984. I believe that's the day they issued the Bob Marley Legend Collection is why this date is the chapter. But I could be wrong. But anyway, it starts out with David Robinson, who was the founder of Stiff Records, which is the label that put out Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and The Damned and Ian Dury and the Blockheads and et cetera, et cetera. He had run a small label, but run it really tight. And then he joined Island Records, which was a whole different kettle of fish. It was the classic 60s, 70s hippie empire of stoner, King Stoner, Chris Blackwell, who had, you know, I mean, been involved with ska and Blue Beat and the birth of reggae, and I mean, you know, put out so many great records from Jamaica, starting with you know, My Boy Lollipop by Millie Small and on, but Bob Marley, of course, had become the jewel in his crown. And then Bob Marley had sadly died in his early 30s of cancer in 1980 or 81, I want to say. But anyway, David Robinson comes along, joins Island, and figures out, you know what? We don't have a Bob Marley greatest hits, and that's what we need to do. And that was the right call. They put together the Legend compilation and blew the doors off. I mean, that thing was massive. How many cars have you seen that CD or cassette in?
Oh, yeah. It's so true. It's so ubiquitous.
Yeah, and the posters and the whole bit. I mean, I'm not sure if I, you know, I was only 13 or 15 at the time. I'm not I definitely heard of Bob Marley while he was alive, but this Legends was the first one I owned, and that was the first poster I got. And so, you know, thanks to David Robinson for kind of introducing me to Bob Marley in a big way.
Sure.
But one thing I thought was interesting was that Robinson's mantra on this was stay out of the more political songs. Bob Marley was a great pop songwriter, a great pop songwriter who had a way of putting deep meaning into the most innocent terms. And yet, it's got Get Up, Stand Up on it. I mean, I think it's got Buffalo Soldier on it. It raised my consciousness. I guess that's
mine too. Mine too. And when I was listening to it, was in the 90s. I hate to admit that. I mean, I was exposed to Bob before then, but I always thought it was dim belly full, but we hungry. You know, I mean, I always thought it had that aspect to it.
Yeah, it definitely did. I don't think there's any way to completely render Bob Marley politically toothless, but
right.
You know, but it's a great pop collection. It obviously, you know, worked for itself. And it's interesting that they launched it in the UK with a TV ad campaign, which was, you know, I wasn't watching UK TV at the time, obviously, but in America, TV ad campaigns were associated with, you know, KTEL and artists that were not, you know, it wasn't A-list artist stuff that you did that for. So it was a pretty novel strategy, and it worked. It topped the UK charts for 14 weeks. They didn't even release it in the States until August, but just a massive thing. And I think one of the things about the 80s that gets overlooked a lot is how much more popular Bob Marley was in the 80s in America than he was in the 70s. And also, I would tie that in with how much more popular the Grateful Dead was in the 80s than they were in the 70s. And the whole ganja culture around Bob Marley and the acid culture around the Grateful Dead was a huge part of 80s underground pop culture. You know, everybody talks about cocaine, but those two drugs, I think, were a big piece of it. But Matos, as is his wont. And I guess we should go ahead and play our first song. Let's go ahead and drop, you know, this is Bob Marley, Is This Love, the first song on the Classic Legend right. compilation. And that was Bob Marley, Is This Love, from the Legend compilation. And so Matos is doing some pretty clever things here. He's using Marley and this as a, well, I mean, he's kind of introducing Marley because the rest of the chapter is going to be kind of the record. It's going to be twofold. It's going to be one part, the record industry's search for the next Bob Marley, which essentially boils down to, you know, scouring Jamaica and the Caribbean and even Africa for artists that they thought might have that potential to break through and become, you know, a Bob Marley level superstar, which is colossal. You can't.
Yeah.
It's almost even impossible to fathom how famous Bob Marley became in this period. I mean, you know, the Bob Marley t-shirt and the Che Guevara t-shirt are on comparable levels yeah. worldwide. But Che Guevara never went multi-platinum in the States with an album. Yeah. But the second thing that Matos is doing is that he's talking about the way the record industry had started to take more care with their reissues. And this is going to become a bigger and bigger theme from the early 80s all through the 90s and into the early 2000s until, you know, the MP3 thing killed the CD era. But the record industry figured out that their catalogs, especially with the new CD format, that there was gold in them, their vaults, and they could just repackage, and people wanted to buy old music. But you know, and he again connects it to the 1979 crash, because, you know, keep in mind, the record industry in the States after World War II had been recession proof. It rock and rolled through the recession right after World War II. It didn't hit any bumps in the 50s. I'm not even sure if there was a recession in the 60s, but it rode through the 73 recession, no problem. But the 79 recession caught the record industry with their pants down. And this is when they figured out, oh, we need to look for other ways to make money. And that's, you know, when they started activating their back catalog. And MCA, he points out, in 1982, MCA earned $20 million from back catalog and reissue sales. Now, you're old enough to remember MCA, just like I am. Was that a janky record label or what?
Well, Elton John, who was my favorite in eighth grade and into seventh grade, and then Lynyrd Skynyrd were both huge. You know, Lynyrd Skynyrd wrote a song about it.
Yeah,
that's right. And so, I mean, I was kind of MCA centric.
Yeah,
but they are kind of it.
Yeah, I mean, they put out some great records, but my impression of their back catalog sales in the 80s was seeing a lot of albums that were discount priced, that were greatest hit sets, that had the big MCA label on it, and seeing them all over the place. The label just, it went from one of the industry leaders before the 80s into just lower and lower fortunes, I think, over time, and eventually, became bombed. But the other thing Matos talks about here is that it wasn't just labels dumping out their catalogs willy-nilly, that they're starting in the 70s, that a few labels had started to really curate the archives of, starting with blues, rhythm and blues, and country artists. And he shouts out Bear Family Records and Richard Visa, which was founded in 1975. And I mean, if you're a serious hardcore record fan, Google Bear Family Records and track down their stuff. If you like country, rockabilly, blues, rhythm and blues, they've probably put out a 9-volume CD set with an incredible book to go with it that you can probably find used at a big discount from the sales price. But, Matos shouts out in particular the 14 LP set of Lefty Frizzell's complete works that Bear Family put out in 1984, which, one of my favorite, absolute stone favorite artists in any category, definitely my favorite country artist. So this was important work. And he also talks about Charlie Records, which started in 1974, and they specialize in putting out Sun reissues. And the guy, and I'm blanking on his name, but he's the guy who made a fortune off of Harper Valley PTA, and then Sam Phillips sold him the Sun catalog, and he worked with Charlie, basically gave Charlie the keys to the vaults. And so their big release in 1984 was Sun Records, The Blues Years, 1950 to 1956. And I just did an episode with Peter Goralnik about his great new book about Sun Records. And, when we think about Sun, I mean, who do you think of when you think of Sun Records?
Elvis.
And who do you think of next?
Jerry Lee Lewis.
And who's
Johnny
next?
Cash. And Sam Phillips. I'm sorry, Sam Phillips.
Yeah, and Carl Perkins and Charlie Rich and et cetera, et cetera. And those are perfectly rational choices. That's who you think of when you think of Sun Records, but you don't think about Junior Parker and all the other great the Prisoners and all the other great blues and R&B artists that Sam Phillips recorded. Now, and this stuff didn't even include the stuff he cut with Ike Turner or B.B. King or Howlin' Wolf, Sam Phillips recorded for other labels. But nonetheless, that I've heard that Sun Records, The Blues Years comp, and it makes a serious case that Sam Phillips clearly had his ear to the ground and was working hard in the R&B field. It's just that he didn't have the massive hits. It's fascinating. I mean, for a guy who basically cut a number one R&B record with Rocket 88, with Jackie Brinson and his Bearcats, or whatever that they put on the label, but it was Ike Turner and his Rhythm Kings that made that record. And, you know, and Sam couldn't recapture that on his own. And you know, I don't know. I think there's kind of an aspect of fate in there that. But anyway, the point is that Sun Records, the blues years, kind of restored Sun Records' reputation as a blues and R&B label to where it should have been. And then he also mentions Ace Records, which is still going, and so is Bear Family. I'm not sure about Charlie, but Ace is still going and putting out great stuff. But they had licensed the Lori Records catalog, which, you know, Deep and Dion and the Belmonts, and then Specialty, which had, you know, Little Richard and Lori Price and, you know, on and on and on, a ton of great stuff. And then, of course, he talks about Rhino Records, which, I don't know, were you aware of Rhino around this time? Or?
You know, I want to say I was. I think they were the first ones that got on my radar. But the thing that I found when reading this time was wishing that I'd bought so many things that they reissued, that I'd been more present about what they were doing, because there was a lot of stuff that you can't get any more from them.
Yeah. A lot of their compilations, they specialized in putting together compilations that would take more, like most compilations or greatest hits albums would just look at one label's catalog of an artist. But when you're looking back at an artist, you know, 25 years after their heyday, you really don't care what label they were on for this hit or that hit. You want all the hits. And Rhino would take the trouble and license all those songs. But the downside of that is that those licenses were generally for that one issue, you know, that album or, you know, cassette CD. And it hasn't carried over into the streaming era. And so a lot of those Rhino collections...
Really?
Yeah, if you can find them, you know, in a hard copy, that's a good way to do it. Or you can also just, a lot of times you can just look at what was on the playlist and just make your own playlist and reconstruct those compilations.
Oh, yeah.
The key is finding the right versions, because you'll get on Spotify and you'll be, you know, you put together, here's the songs I want to hear, and you put it all on there. And then you're hearing, you know, a collection of Dion and the Belmont songs, and all of a sudden the strings are replaced with synthesizers and Dion sounds a little old, maybe a little heavy, and you're like, I think this is a re-recording from later. And you know, that's the kind of thing that'll drive a dork like me crazy. So
yeah,
you know, but let's go ahead and hear our next tune, which is another artist who was getting the big reissue treatment around this period. And I'm going to make an argument after we hear the song. So this is James Brown, Give It Up or Turn It Loose. And that was James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose, an early 70s classic that was reissued by Polydor, I think that year, that Polydor issued two volumes of the James Brown story at the same time as that Solid Smoke reissued the Federal years, parts 1 and 2 of James Brown. And Federal was a subsidiary of King Records owned by Sid Nathan, which makes me have to mention the late Seymour Stein, who just passed away this weekend, because he was Sid Nathan's literal protege.
Yeah.
But James Brown is somebody that when I was a kid, I can remember seeing him on TV in his Mr. Mustache era and getting a wild hair and wanting to hear more James Brown. Like, I was probably the only person in the world who, hadn't heard of James Brown already and liked the Mustache James Brown disco era. But I remember going to the record store and not finding anything. And one of my older brothers even took me to a used record store where I managed to find some James Brown stuff. But before these reissues, you couldn't find James Brown for a little while. I think in the late 70s, early 80s, he was just out of print. Yeah, which is so hard to imagine. And Matos, he's kind of tweaking Christgau, because he quotes Christgau reviewing, I think, the James Brown story from Polydor. And he calls it, this is the place to start convincing yourself that JB belongs in the pantheon with Elvis and the Beatles. Now, in 2023, that sounds dumb as fuck. Apologies to the great Mr. Chris Cowell. But I mean, to you know, at this point in time, it's pretty much like you got to convince yourself that Elvis and the Beatles belong in the pantheon with James Brown.
There you go.
So it's weird to see, which honestly, I think they're all three monumentally great, influential artists. But nonetheless, the idea that James Brown was not regarded that way back in the day is pretty shocking. And if you go further back and read the reviews from the 70s or the 60s, he was definitely not appreciated by rock critics. I mean, obviously he was appreciated by the fans, but
yeah. Did you know he was on Letterman the first summer of David Letterman's show?
I did not. That was before.
It was 82. Yes, and it was 82. And what is really strange is he's from Augusta, Georgia, or Augusta, South Carolina, which is pretty close. It's closer to Athens than Atlanta. And he somehow became a Georgia football fan. And so I was exposed to him a little bit because of that, because my dad was one and I went to Georgia. And it wasn't because Athens was a hip place or because we were smart. But when he was on Letterman, he actually played a medley that included the song that was adapted for Georgia's football team. And he sang the Georgia version, which was really funny. So, but he was like I was actually outside a locker room at their Sanford Stadium in Athens, and he was there. And he's not a real tall guy.
No,
but he was at that point. Yes, he was, but he was more like a cartoon character. And you know, I did see him late. I did encounter him later when I was much more, you know, with it. By which time I had played some songs in a band with, you know, some James Brown songs, but he was just not, it's strange how what you just described happened for somebody that is so great and so important.
And, but I mean, I think because his songs, like if you're coming from the Great American Songbook, or even the Lennon and McCartney, or the Lieber and Stoller songwriting tradition, James Brown chords tend to be vamps on songs tend to be vamps on one chord, with improvised lyrics, very little melody, and so for people who are listening for that kind of songwriting, he's not really doing very much, and they completely slept on the fact that he's absolutely revolutionizing rhythm, and he's bringing polyrhythms. Yep. He's turning a band into, you know, like a Cuban style polyrhythmic, you know, drum orchestra. And people just didn't. I mean, people appreciated it; they were hits at the time, and that's what people danced to. But people didn't grasp the magnitude of it. And here's what I want to talk about is that this is also right before, this is 1984. So like this year, James Brown and Afrika Bambaataa collaborate on a track called Unity, which is really the first bridge between hip hop artists and old school R&B guys. And it wasn't a big hit. I don't even know if it made, it definitely didn't make the pop charts. I think it barely scraped into the top 100 R&B. But it's on this verge. Like, what's about to happen is Run DMC is about to come, and Matos will get to all this in a later chapter. But just a couple years later, Eric B. of Eric B. and Rakim is going to start making these records that are just built on James Brown samples. Like, the sampling technology comes to a point where it's cheap enough for these young black street producers to get their hands on them, people like Marley Marl and Eric B. and you know, Hank Shockley and the Public Enemy crew and the Bomb Squad and all those cats. But they were so James Brown focused. And, you know, I'm sure they'll all tell you they were digging in the crates and that they had all the original. And a lot of them probably did. I'm sure their parents and older brothers and sisters had those old James Brown records. But I also bet you anything that half those DJs were sampling off these new compilations that had just come out. You know, it's just something, the more I research musicians, the more I realize they're kids that don't have any historical perspective. And if something is common in the marketplace, that's what they're probably going to find. You know, later on in the 90s, you get these more sophisticated, generation of crate diggers, you know, J. Dilla, et cetera, and you know, all the guys of the Wu-Tang Clan, et cetera, that are digging through the crates looking for these obscure early 70s records. But at this point in the 80s, I'm betting that I'm just saying that the magnitude and the impact of these James Brown reissues is not to be underestimated. And if you're sitting here thinking, you know, where's Boy George? Where's Michael Jackson? When are we ever going to get to Prince? Where's Bruce Springsteen? Why are you talking about Bob Marley and James Brown in a 1984 show? It's Matos is, you know, Matos is making these decisions. And I think this is a really smart one because the magnitude of the impact of older records, things like Bob Marley Legend, these James Brown comps and all these other comps we've been talking about, this was a big impact on pop culture at the time. And then he gets into Elvis and talks about how, you know, RCA puts out a 6 LP box set, Elvis, a Golden Celebration, which was 20 tape reels that they had discovered in Graceland that RCA A&R Joan Deary found and like smuggled out of Graceland and rushed back to RCA to get these things, you know, the printing plant. And what they figured out was, the big thing that happened was, this is the first time that pop music is being marketed to adults since the 50s, if not before. I mean, that Matos says the quote, longstanding directive to sell rock to teenagers changed. Like we rock is now mature enough that they realized, oh, Elvis fans are in their 30s to 50s now. And at this point, Elvis, those same Elvis fans, I mean, are in their 80s to deceased. And, you know, in the 80s, it's majority female. They listen to country or adult contemporary radio. Then they were more apt to buy an expensive box set than a cheap single. Hence, you know, the marketing. And that's why, you know, what you see these days is like lavish repackaging of grunge band catalogs or whatever and stuff, you know, people our age.
Yeah.
You know, want to buy with some money and all that. But let's go ahead and take a quick sponsor break. And when we come back, we're going to switch to the hunt for the next Bob Marley.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once. New quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
And so with Bob Marley moving units to the degree he is, because Legend didn't just go multi-platinum on its own, it also triggered a rush on his back catalog. I know I bought Catch a Fire and Exodus, a bunch of albums once I got Legend, and I wasn't the only one. And everybody in the record industry is looking at this and going, I wonder where the next Bob Marley is. And as Matos points out, that there had been lots of hit reggae songs on the radio in this period. I mean, he cites Roxanne by the Police, Down Under by Men at Work, Blondie's cover of The Tide Is High, Stevie Wonder, Master Blaster, Culture Club, Do You Really Want to Hurt Me? And what's missing in that picture? When you think collections of great reggae songs, what's the one factor missing there?
Not any reggae music, not any true, Jamaicans.
Yeah. Not a Jamaican. Nary a Jamaican on that list. We've got England, we've got Australia, we've got Detroit, we've got New York. No Jamaicans. And so, as Mata says, the music was getting out, but the Jamaican artists weren't getting the credit. And so one thing that was going on was that the sound in Jamaica had changed, that the pop artists are still digesting and reproducing what Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer and Black Uhuru, et cetera, had been doing in the early – Black Uhuru is kind of later. But what all these artists had done in the early 70s and the pop scene was still digesting it and catching up with it throughout the late 70s and early 80s. But the sound actually had moved on – actually just starts moving on right around this time in Jamaica. And that's where you get Yellow Man, a.k.a. Winston Foster, who represents what became known as dancehall. And the nomenclature of dancehall is interesting because they didn't see it as a self-conscious new style. But it was just a fact that was what was being made on the records and what was being played internationally was different than what was still being played in the dance halls. Like the dance halls had stayed contemporary and were moving on, and synths and drum machines and stuff were starting to get in there, and the sound is changing. And somebody like Yellow Man, the last thing on his mind in the 80s, I guarantee you, is Bob Marley. I mean, I'm sure he was aware of and reverent towards yada, 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 but he's not waiting for Peter Tosh to give him the A-OK on what he's going to do next. This is new generation of Jamaicans that are saying their piece and ready to go on. And so dancehall, for me, like when I was doing the Techno Roll series, I really got into dancehall because as a kid, I was always like, oh, that's when it all went south. That's when it got ruined. When it was roots reggae, it was righteous. But then, this modern dancehall stuff's not righteous. And it's like, what does a white kid in Borger, Texas have to tell Yellow Man, about being authentic or whatever? And once I had kind of clicked to, oh, synth music can be cool, I went back and really dug it. But nonetheless, I don't think anybody thought Yellow Man, who's an albino African a Jamaican of African descent, was going to be a big star in America. I mean, he had some killer songs that I think could have probably had a bigger impact in the States. But no A&R guy is going to look at Yellow Man and be, this is the next Bob Marley. So we're going to have to continue the quest with Reuben Blades. Now, this, were you surprised when Reuben Blades pops in here?
Yes, I was. And I mean, it also surprised me because I remember how much, I was at a festival one time and he was performing there and he was also in movies, and how, what a cultural, kind of a cultural force, mini force that he was for this. This seems like a window of time.
Yeah. And I was aware of him as the star of Crossover Dreams, which was a movie he made, I guess, around 84. I heard of the music and read reviews of it, but I didn't actually hear the music anywhere. There wasn't a lot of salsa radio in my neck of the woods. But it's interesting. This was kind of his big year. And Matos kind of gives his career retrospective that he's Panamanian. but moved to New York City in 69, was in the salsa scene, which was, you know, the Puerto Ricano New York City scene. I mean, obviously lots of Cuban influences as well, and other Caribbean influences as well. So I was interested about the Panamanian thing. I mean, to me, it's fascinating the way that the music travels around the Caribbean and then the different aspects of it. So I wasn't expecting one of the top salsa singers of the late 70s, early 80s to be Panamanian, but I, you know, whatever, it's a free world. But he moved, he sings for Ray Barreto on Fania Records, and then he moves on to Willie Colon's band in 1977. He replaced Hector Laveau, and then kind of blew the doors off of that niche. Like their album, Colon's album, Siembra, sold between 300,000 and 1 million, which is, as Macho says, a lot for salsa, which is a market where 40,000 was a hit. So Blades is already punching above his weight just as a sideman. And then in 1984, he signs with Elektra. So Elektra is thinking, aha, maybe Ruben Blades will be the next, you know, Bob Marley. Maybe we'll be have some Latin flavor in there. And they put out his album, Buscando America, which does 10,000 sales initially. And then Blades goes to Harvard Law School starting in fall of 1984. Did you see that one coming?
Like, no. And the movies I saw him in were after that.
Yeah.
So did he become a movie star after that? Is that?
I think he's.
Am I reading that right?
I didn't research this in depth enough. Apologies. But I think he shot Crossover Dreams before he went to Harvard Law School. But if you're an A&R guy and you're trying to make the next Bob Marley out of a dude and he goes to law school, you'd have to think, well, I'm going to just cut the marketing budget a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I think that might be part of why Ruben Blades never became, you know, the next Bob Marley or never. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he got bigger than this, but I think this is his high watermark. So
well, he was performing when I saw him. It was 88, fall of 88. Or I didn't actually see him. I was at a festival where a bunch of different bands were playing, and he was one of them. And I mean, I knew who he was then. And I'm not saying that's when it, but I think you're right. He continued to make waves of a sort, but it was interesting to see his name pop up.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, it was a swerve I was not expecting. Like, I was expecting Yellow Man and the next couple of artists we're going to talk about, but I did not see Ruben Blades coming in this. But it makes perfect sense. And it's also really, you know, is there that big a difference between salsa and reggae? Well, yeah, but also they're all Caribbean musics, you know, and they're out groups, you know, in the Anglo-dominated U.S. So, you know, it makes perfect sense to lump him in there. But let's go ahead. I just had to pick this song. I couldn't resist picking Yellow Man. And the only way I can pronounce this is to try to sing it, so I'm not going to do that. But this is a very long, unpronounceable word that Yellow Man makes roll off his tongue in a beautiful song. So good. Yeah, I can't even say it unless I can sing it. I'm not going to try to sing it. But here's Yellow Man with one of his big hits from 1984.
Well, you see if this rhythm you have a patch, Yellow Man made it. And you see after me don't made it, me set it. Zungo, zungo, go, zungo, zen. Zungo, zungo, go, zungo, zen. Say if you have a paper, you must have a pen. And if you have a start, you must have a end. Say 5 + 5, it equal to 10. And if you have both, you put them in a bin. And if you have a rooster, you must have a end. Now, zungo, zungo, go, zungo, zen. Zungo, zungo, go, zungo, zen. Jump for happiness and jump.
And that was Yellow Man with, and I'm going to blow it again. I was so sure when I was listening to that I could remember it. But anyway, y'all heard the title. Zunga Zanga Gazunga Zang. I guess as close as I
very good.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Works for me.
I'm glad I got the Ed Lex seal of approval on that.
You do. But,
but the next artist that they talk about is that Island Records themselves, the people who broke Bob Marley internationally, made Bob Marley as a pop performer, they jump on King Sunny a Day and his African Beats. And I remember this stuff getting a fair amount of attention. And it's funny, it seems like Fela Kuti has kind of overshadowed King Sunny a Day, maybe in the long run. I mean, and maybe that's just my misimpression. But at the time, you know, and reading this, it definitely reminded me King Sunny a Day was a much bigger deal in the States at the time than Fela Kuti was. Do you remember any, did this make any impression on you at the time?
Yeah, you know, I want to say that I was in a band with a guy who, before we kind of went our commercial way, was totally dialed in, and he saw King Sunny a Day and was just out of his mind about him. But this was more like 87, so it was a little later.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think of Fela as being more that mega giant than King Sunny a Day.
Yeah. I think that's probably the historical consensus, but again, I'm not an Afropop specialist, so
me neither.
But it's interesting. And so Island puts out King Sunny a Day. They brand him. They don't brand him explicitly, but like what they're telling people is this is the next Bob Marley. Like that's part of the sales pitch. They put out three albums on their subsidiary Mango label, Juju Music, Synchro System, and Aura. And they were, and I could be wrong here. My impression is that this was all stuff that he had already recorded and put out in Africa. And so I'm not sure if they re-recorded those songs or if they compiled those songs into new albums. But anyway, it was new stuff for the US and UK markets. And then what was interesting to me, and this is where I heard of him, was Juju made number 4 in the Village Voice annual Paz and Jop poll, which was a big deal at the time. And I mean, all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it was a big deal. And I didn't even get my hands on the Village Voice, but somehow I still heard about the Paz and Jop poll. I think through a magazine I got in Dallas that, you know, lasted 4 issues or something, but had a big had a reference to that. And that was also where I first heard about a hip-hop, was that same random magazine purchase. But Sunny a Day, it has a whole story how the A&R man was in Africa, was in Nigeria, and was actually working with Fela Kuti and heard Sunny a Day on the radio, and or maybe playing on a tape in a cab driver's car, and jumped on board, and that's why Sunny a Day got the push. And he toured the States in 1983, was promoted by Paul Rhodes Trotman, who was also the manager of John Lurie's Lounge Lizards, which is kind of a no wave Afropop connection I wasn't expecting. But one thing that Matos points out that I think is important is that these kind of African beats, the Talking Heads on their Remain in Light album and all their subsequent tours, we talked about them last week, incorporated a lot of African rhythms. Adam Ant and Bow Wow Wow and Malcolm McLaren on the English side had also put African beats on the pop charts. So people were kind of primed. They'd heard this stuff in a different context, and now they were hearing it in the original context and making some headway. But I thought it was interesting that Sunny a Day only got radio play in Boston and Chicago, but then did very well on his tour on U.S. campuses, powered by a New York Times review by the late, great Robert Palmer. And also did well in dance clubs. His song 365 Is My Number and The Message were big at The Loft, which is a legendary disco that was pretty long in the tooth by this point. I assume it maybe did well in The Loft a couple years earlier than this. But then he tours again in 1984 with Black Uhuru opening up, promoted by the FBI, not the Federal Bureau of Investigations, but Ian Copeland's booking agency. That's the brother of Miles Copeland of IRS Records and Stuart Copeland of the band The Police. And so they dropped Troutman, who had promoted their first successful tour, and move up the food chain to Ian Copeland. And Matos kind of diagnoses that certain qualities were lost in the desire to make King Sunny a Day a U.S. style star. And so that the groundwork that they had laid in 83, that they pushed too hard or tried to make him into something that he really wasn't and kind of lost the magic. He also mentions Black Uhuru's compilation album, Reggae Greats, which was Island trying to repackage their catalog into kind of a what Matos calls a second bite at the Legend album, Legend Apple. Sorry to mess up your metaphor, Michelangelo. And Martin Messonnier was the producer and manager, and also produced Fela Kuti. And he mentions you, Masekela's Don't Go Lose a Baby. Hit number two on the dance charts this year. And Yu Masekela is somebody who'd been around. I mean, he played horns on So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star by the Byrds in 1967. So he'd been around and been on the scene, South African musician, and was very important. But let's go ahead and hear our one last song. This is King Sunny Ade doing Ja Fun Mi live in the States in 1983.
What do you mean?
And that was King Sunny Ade's Ja Fun Mi live in 1983. And that's pretty much what I got. You got anything to add here, Ed? We're kind of short episode.
Well, I wondered, I want to try on something somebody said to me, a guy who I knew from, he was from Dublin, and he was a no wave or post-punk. I think he was actually in a legitimate band in Dublin and London. But then he became a DJ, and I met him in Minneapolis, and he was good enough at it that he flew all over the world to DJ, and he actually DJed at Paisley Park for three parties that were Prince's parties.
Wow.
He got fired the third one. He showed up for the gig. The guy walked out and said, "You're fired." And he said, "I didn't even know I was hired," because Prince had started talking to him, and that must and liked him.
Uh-oh.
And was talking guitar with him, and he thought that must have threatened somebody.
Yeah,
but and this was like in the early 2000s. But he was a guy that I learned a lot about the nature of discrimination from, because he's from Ireland and England, and the Irish famine and the IRA and the Belfast and all that stuff, which I know a little bit about because I lived in England a little while. But I learned so much from him about the nature of some of that stuff that's so different from the discrimination we have here in the good old US of A. But he told me he also was a Buddhist. He traveled all over the world and went in a lot of third world places. He said the Beatles aren't the biggest band in the world. Bob Marley is.
Yep.
And I thought that was, and you can't, you're not going to get it. You're not going to, we're not going to ever repeat the Beatles, and you can't get another Bob Marley either. And I believe that. I believe it. I actually got to see Bob Marley in 79.
Oh, wow.
In a theater.
In
the theater where I worked, the Fox Theater, 4,000 seat, packed with people, more black people than white people in Atlanta, Georgia. And I bet they were not African American. I bet they were more Jamaican American or Jamaican, African Jamaican people on there.
Yeah, Afro Caribbean.
It was foggy. Yes, Caribbean. It was the smoke was blue in that room. But it was phenomenal, and I can't take credit because I wanted to leave when we were done. I was an usher, and my buddy almost physically compelled me to stay, and it was epic. I mean, it really was great. I mean, so I kind of believe that about Bob Marley now.
I have no doubt of that. That's a fairly well. I mean, I don't know exactly how you would analyze that, but that's been the I mean, I'm sure there's some way to quantify that, but I've definitely heard that, and that Bob Marley is as famous, or at least was in the 80s, 90s, 2000s. And yeah. Presumably, his Q rating is still pretty high. But he was at Muhammad Ali or Che Guevara levels of international stardom. And the Beatles are in there. I mean, they're big. The Beatles have fans all over Africa and Latin America and everything, too. But not as many as Bob Marley. I mean, Bob Marley, I think, because he was really the first person from the quote-unquote third world, which is a pretty awful term, but a lot of people globally identified with him because he was coming from Jamaica, which was clearly not part of the, you know, North American, Western European, quote-unquote, first world. It's not Japan. It's not South Korea. Yeah. You know, it's a relatively impoverished country with a history of slavery and colonial exploitation. Yeah. And here comes this guy becoming, you know, it took him a while. Like, you know, we've talked about it a few times on the show, and I'm going to do an episode on Marley specifically pretty soon. But he was, it wasn't a quick breakthrough. He broke through in England first, and African Americans were actually a very hard demo for Bob Marley to break through with. That he broke through with white college rockers and first, but then. And it's classic, you know, there's a great Chuck D quote from the 80s when he was, you know, big with Public Enemy, and he started getting contact, you know, he starts moving in higher circles or whatever. And so, like, some ad executive approached him one time and was like, how do I sell Ford Broncos to black people? And Chuck D was like, you sell them to white people and we'll follow along. And I think, you know, I mean, which is... I'm clearly quoting Chuck D to get some validation here, because if I just say that on my own, people are just going to be like, shut up, white boy. But I think there's some truth to that. I mean, obviously, plenty of occasions when you market things to white people by selling them to black people first, or black people invent something culturally and then white people steal it, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also, I think, a factor of once Bob Marley was a megastar with white people, then black people gave him a different look rather than, or African-Americans in the States. That overcame whatever intra-African diaspora beef there is between North American, you know, North Americans of African descent and Caribbean people of African descent. So, you know, any ethnic group you get into, as you subdivide it, the fights will continue, and it just splits into smaller and smaller groups. And so that stuff was fascinating. But I also think you should give yourself some credit, because you went and saw Bob Marley the same time as HR and the Bad Brains did for the first time. So, you know, like,
you're kidding. That's where they saw him, really?
I don't know. Really? It was that show, but it was that tour. But they saw him in
that
DC.
Tour, yes. You know, and I had to look up when that tour. I had to look online to see when a ticket, what the date was it on it. That particular concert is, I was already in college, so I was not working at the theater as much. And that, it almost is like it happened outside of time. And it was just, and I was not, I wasn't hearing any Bob Marley on the radio. I didn't know any of his songs. I think I knew one song with Pat Travers covered one of his songs.
Oh God.
So I knew it was the one you played tonight. The one, Is This Love. I knew that one because of Pat Travers. But I mean, it was,
and of course,
it
I
was
saw
one
the
of those.
With
okay, of course. Good point. I've never thought of that as reggae.
No.
But you're right, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it's a Bob Marley song, and Clapton's version is relatively, you know, respectful, perfectly fine version.
It is.
But it's not the Bob Marley version. I mean, you know, and in retrospect, when you are used to the Bob Marley version, you hear the Eric Clapton version, it's nothing like hearing the Pat Boone version of, say, Fats Domino or Little Richard.
Yeah, there's a
taste to that. It's not quite the original. And Bob Marley was just kind of a creeper high, you know, like you take a toke and then, you know, 5 years later, he's a big superstar. And his early death, I think, is also a factor because, unfortunately, it's human nature to take people for granted while they're alive. And then I don't want to say over extol them when they're dead. I mean, that certainly happened to John Lennon, you know, the entire myth making thing around the John Lennon after he died in the 80s was really intense. But Marley, I think, got a similar thing. And I think internationally it was even bigger because he became the symbol of international, of African diaspora triumph on the international pop culture stage. And I think that the magnitude of what that meant to ensuing generations of Africans, of Caribbeans, of African Americans, of Anglo Americans, I mean, it meant a lot to a lot of people. And I mean, of course, you're going to see so many white kids start growing dreadlocks, and et cetera, in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of them were coming by way of the Bad Brains. But the Bad Brains point you to Bob Marley. But like I said, if you go back and look at the Bad Brains in 1979, like the Spot Black Spot album, which was, you know, unreleased demos at the time, there's no reggae influence there whatsoever. And I think it's interesting to see just how rapidly and how massively seeing Bob Marley impacted their music and the Clash and the Police and et cetera, et cetera. But it's interesting. This
well, it's coming from a real place. I mean, Jamaica really is hardcore.
Yeah,
there's no, you're not. It ain't the Bahamas. I lived in Florida and I did go occasionally for work to Jamaica and the Bahamas and other, you know, Caribbean and North Atlantic, the islands and the sun, and Jamaica beats them all. I mean, I haven't been to Cuba, but I mean, Jamaica, man, you talk about it, that is a heavy duty place.
Yeah. I mean, you got to consider Haiti, though, too.
Yes, of course. Yes. Now you're getting Ned Sublet on me, which after I heard him talking about Haiti, I mentioned it to my wife. And boy, that was a big hit, going to Haiti for the drums. Because you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
And Haiti is even more elemental, which is, that's worthy of further thought.
Indeed it is. But we've got lots of Bob Marley to chew on for this episode. And next week we will be back with more of Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. And I really need to start looking ahead a little bit because I need to tell our audiences, we're going to be talking about country music in 1984 next time. So
yeah,
that'll be fun. So for Ed Legg, I'm Nate Wilcox. And we've been discussing Michelangelo Matos' Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate concludes the Three Kings of American Pop series with the final part of his discussion of Peter Guralnick's Elvis Presley biography and the HBO documentary The Searcher with Gurdeep Ladar and Justin Galsman of the TCB cast. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.